Okay. I have a instructive comic from Palmer. Last 2 weeks ago, we read a little bit from Genesis, and we read about how God said, "Let us make man in his image." The word for God is Elohim. Elohim actually is a plural word. That's why God can say, "Let us make," because Elohim. So, Palmer, where did you get this?
I was searching the internet, and
this came up. All right, so it looks like there's a pastor teaching a Bible study, and because Palmer asked about this, somebody else asked about this too. So Genesis chapter 1, 26, God says, "Let us make man in our image." And, you know, of course, as Christians, we say, oh, when God says, "Let us make man in our image," we think, oh, it's Trinity, right? Father, Son, Holy Spirit, they're talking amongst themselves, say, "Let us make man in our image." But the word is God. So Elohim is like pants, the pastor said. I'll pass it around. So Elohim is like pants, singular at the top and plural at the bottom. I thought it was funny, Palmer. So it's a pastor joke. So you can pass that one around. Yeah, a little, pastor humor. When my kids' friends come over to my house, they always are. Well, no, they're always wondering. My kids are always wondering how many dumb pastor jokes will he make, and I make a lot. Oh, all the time. Yeah, it's like a double whammy though with me, because it's not just dad jokes. It's pastor dad jokes, you know. Yeah, anyhow. All right, before we pray, a couple announcements. I'm still going to try to work my clicker here. Nice. All right, first of all, for those who came to the men's retreat, you know, in five words or less, how was your experience with the men's retreat? Let's think, like, format, like, you know, the form of it, the speaker, the food, drinks. Nick.
I was just gonna say, regarding the speaker, I thought it was really a good topic, really, really good. I did find myself really getting more into it on Saturday than Friday. Friday was more of a history lesson.
Yeah, right.
And Saturday seemed to be a little more application.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
It's really good. You had to be there on Saturday to really get the full feel of it.
So. Yeah, you know, so one of the things about asking a speaker who has no relationship with St. John, you know, just out of the blue, is the thing you've already said. You know, he might come into the place with a very kind of academic perspective, but I thought he was great, and a great person, I mean, great teacher. Well, and then that's why I asked him too. But you know, by the time on Saturday, he made a quick study of all you guys and was able to adjust. I ended up having to talk to him on the phone later that day, and he mentioned explicitly how impressed he was with you gentlemen and your thoughts and your questions. So he might have changed it a little bit, is what I'm trying to say, Nick. Yeah. So that's interesting that you picked up on that. That's great. To Nick's comment about him sounding very Lutheran, like I made that announcement, I think, on Saturday, or was it Friday night? I can't remember, about why he was approached. And he knew his Lutheran, or he knew his Luther, you know, and he had, of course, a specific perspective on Luther that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily always agree with. However, yeah, he sounded very similar to us. In fact, did he say in the thing about becoming Lutheran, I could be Lutheran here at St. John? Is that it? Was that, okay. I couldn't tell if that was just him and I talking. And that, see, what's interesting about this is a longer story, but Matt Milner, the guy who taught in November here, right, Dr. Milner, he's the guy who turned me in onto Dr. Peters. But Matt Milner and a couple other Wheaton College professors who go to Anglican churches, I've talked to them about, you know, St. John, and they all love St. John. St. John has a great reputation at Wheaton College. And one of them, an economics professor, so a couple of the Anglican churches in the area have had a little rough spots and some tough times amongst the congregation, and we ended up talking about those times because St. John has had some tough times too. So talking with these gentlemen, you know, they have wives and families, and they were concerned about their church and how it would affect their spouses and their families. And they both said, well, if our church blows up, it'll be okay because we'll just go down to St. John. So I took that as a compliment. And I think Dr. Peters would probably be of the same mind of that. Dr. Peters, you know, he was a Southern Baptist, became an Anglican. And I don't know if you noticed, because I asked him about this. In his story, Lutheranism, like, never was an option in his mind, because he had never really met a Lutheran like you guys. And so, if you know anything about kind of the Christian landscape in the United States, the people who are probably the closest to us are, in fact, the Anglicans. Not all Anglicans, but a particular group of Anglicans. And so, you know, it makes sense that he would say that, and his journey would take him where he ended up. But like these two Wheaton College professors, there's no reason for them not to leave their church. There's no reason for them to not be Anglican. And because, as Nick said, right, that guy sounded kind of Lutheran. Well, that's because, you know, Luther speaks of the Bible, and, you know, he's not the only guy who sounds that way. So that was, I was glad that happened. That's great, awesome. Now, I know David said we didn't sing so well, but did you guys, I'm teasing you, I'm totally teasing. I thought it was great, but did you guys, I mean, I feel like this is one of the best things about us getting together is singing and praying, and did you guys like having all three? It was a lot to ask. We had three prayer services. I mean, we're turning into monks here, I tell you, yeah, so. Was that okay? I mean, was that okay to have all three? Well, you can tell me later if you think it's terrible, but I mean, that is very different than our previous retreats, right? I mean, we had anything like that. Okay, great. You guys want to tell me more? Great. The reason why I'm asking that question, too, is summer events. Craig Shields said he would help out, so I think we're all going to Craig Shields' house. The reason why I'm asking about summer events is, and this is, you don't need to write this down or anything, but June is going to be a pretty crazy month here at St. John. I'm going to be gone for a few weeks. Pastor Bruzik's going to be gone for a few weeks. Pastor Witt's going to be gone for a couple weeks. And so we're not going to meet in June. We just physically can't. We will have a new pastor by then. However, I'm not going to say, you know, hey, welcome. Just do everything, and we're all leaving now. Yeah, so that's why. So we'll have a couple events in June. I'm still trying to get Tom Prickett, since he's not here, to get the baseball game going. And July will be a little complicated. So I just got off the phone with Steve Chester before our evening, and we're gonna have a big old cookout at his place. Some of us who've been here long enough remember the old days where we had I don't know why we call it steak fry. Why do they grill them? I don't understand why they call them. And we've had a pig roast. So Steve said to have a pig roast. Did anybody help out with roasting the pig? Did you help out with that before? I was shocked at how cheap the pig was. I mean, it's probably more now because of inflation. It's probably twice the amount, but I think he said it was $120. I mean, he cooked it, but it's pretty cheap for feeding whatever how many guys we had. What's that?
Mine got cut up. It wasn't freezing. 2 1/4 is what I paid.
2 1/4? All right, well, it's still pretty cheap if we have 50 guys. I mean, it's pretty cheap. $1 a guy, $2 a guy. Yeah. No, plus it's pig. Come on, forget about it. Yeah, so that's going to be in early August. So that, I think that will be our kind of our kickoff after the crazy summer. So, but we, yeah, June and July, if we got a few more guys who are willing to kind of spearhead getting together. I think someone said mentioning, can there be guns involved? Just depends on what that means. We're going to rob a bank. It's probably not a good idea. I'm going to shoot some clay pigeons. Sounds good. I'm gonna ask you guys. I don't know. I don't do that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm happy to do it. I just don't do it. I'm a farmer, so. Okay, great. All right. So 2 weeks ago, we did not get through our lesson. So we're gonna try to get through our lesson tonight. Unfortunately, if you guys weren't here 2 weeks ago, we did watch a video on tonic masculinity by Bill Donahue. That was really great. But we're just going to kind of review very quickly. So we've all heard of the term toxic masculinity, which is, you know, kind of a terrible term. The kind of the best definition is that just being a man perpetuates kind of domination and aggression, and it's kind of destructive, especially for femininity. And unfortunately, like, the idea that the solution is to be kind of anti-masculine, and we're going to say, no, that's not the case. The thing is, though, is A Boy's a Man, I recommended this book. Did anybody actually check it out in the last 2 weeks? I still highly recommend it. This is a great sociological study on the state of boys and men. And you'll see then how that our world is really taking this strategy of kind of undermining masculinity to, like, really to the nth degree. Right, I think I mentioned how there's 3 times as many female jet fighter pilots as there is male kindergarten teachers, and nobody's talking about it. The vocation of psychologists, it's like 9 out of 10 are women now, and those going into psychology is just skyrocketing. Same with teaching in general, specifically in elementary school. There are basically no men entering into elementary teaching. I mean, just think about that. Think about all the boys who are in elementary school who have no man teaching them. Whew, that's tough. Anyways, so I highly recommend the book. It's very interesting. He kind of goes over all that. So then we spent some time on our origin story. Every superhero has an origin story. So we talked about how our origin story started, obviously, in Genesis 1 and 2. And I think that's basically where we ended. We were about to enter into the fall of man. Man's fall. But before we do that, we're going to take a look at a video called The Duet. And I think in pictures and in movement, it will kind of summarize Genesis 1 and 2. Now, I apologize. I'm going to show this again on Sunday morning, because my original plan was to not have these classes intersect as much as they do now, but, you know, the best laid plans. So you can come late on Sunday morning is what I'm trying to say. Okay, if you want to come 5 minutes late, it's not a big deal. But this one is called the Duet. It's not necessarily Christian or, you know, but I think it'll make sense when we watch it. Okay, we are going to diagnose that. So, interesting about that story is the first child. Who's the first child in it, by the way? Let's see if we were paying attention.
The boy.
Yeah, actually, that first character that came out of the star was actually the female. Yeah. And so she comes in, but the boy sort of slides in there. So the boy's already there. So this is why it's very interesting. Because it's like Adam and Eve. Eve comes in second. Boy's already there. Now, the other thing, though, too, is the presence of the dog. Does anyone know art history in terms of the dog being present in art? Especially with knights. Let me ask you a different question. What's an old-fashioned name of a dog? Quintessential name. Rover, what?
Oh, the name?
Yeah. Fido. Right, it's an old, you know, a lot of old dogs, right, called Fido. Does anyone know what Fido means in Latin?
Faithful.
Faith. So the presence of the dog is really instructive there because I find it very interesting that the dog is there because there's no reason for the dog to be there, but it's there. So it's communicating something. There's two distinct actions that the boy and the girl do. What's the boy doing the entire time? Well, he's definitely watching her. That's right. But what is he doing? There's some big time movements that he's doing. Yeah, he's exploring. He's climbing on the rocks. He's skateboarding. Then, climbing on the small rocks, and then at the end, right? He's got to climb up the cliff. Now, those are very masculine things that he does, and. You know, rock is generally like a symbol for men, right? He's climbing it. And of course, what's the girl doing? She's dancing, right? Now, the reason why this is important is because, for instance, the boy climbs the tree. You know, he's challenged by this tree, this feat of strength. And he gets to the inside up to the tree, and then who's already there? Do you notice that? The girl's already there. So what's interesting about this video is that there is this equality but difference at the same time. That, you know, the girl's already in the tree. Doesn't mean she's better than the boy or more advanced than the boy. It's just that she also has feats of strength that she embarks on. The culmination of her ballet. You guys notice what was the final scene before they come together for her? She was in the auditorium, right? She was in the theater. Like, think about, how many people love to be in front of crowds and like to get, you know, perform in front of thousands of people. It takes a special person to do that. It takes a person who's willing to put themselves out there to take risks. But of course, she does it as a ballerina. The boy, though, of course, at the end, his quest, his, you know, risk-taking, is climbing that rock, climbing the waterfall. There's danger involved. And so I think the video is really great at really demonstrating how there are differences between the man and the woman, but at the same time, there's this common equality with them. But what's interesting, though, too, about the boy is not only is he looking at her, there's a couple times where they're kind of engaged, like, with one another. Because the girl falls a couple times. The first time she falls, what happens? What does the man do? What does the boy do? She doesn't notice. He just looks at her. Dog comes and licks her face, and then she goes off her merry way. The second time she falls, what happens? He's there to catch her. He's there to intervene. That's the difference between men and boys. Men are there to intervene, to catch, to protect. And we see that in Genesis. We'll get to that in a second, though. Now, What's also interesting about this is that their feats of strength, their risk-taking, their engagement in kind of growing up, they're not actually together until the very end. I mean, they're living in relationship with one another, right, throughout this kind of video. But at the end is that they finally come together, and of course, they are at the top together. This is really important. There's this progression in their relationship of intimacy and closeness. But most of the time, it's just that they are living in relationship with one another, even though they are not together. And the reason why that's important is because masculinity, as it's lived out in fullness, always must live in relationship to woman, regardless if you're married or not. Because if you close yourself, if masculinity closes itself off to femininity, then it limits itself. Now, it wasn't, I think it was probably, this is probably the least explicit part of the video, is that you, now the reason why I say that is because, why did he climb the tree? Well, because he's a boy and that's what boys do. Well, she's already in the tree. So is he climbing the tree to get a better, there's this idea like he's always living in relationship to her. Even when they're infants, they're living in relationship with one another. And that is, so that's important for us as men, is that we have to understand that we cannot close ourselves off to females, because if it's just us, we're missing something out in life. And that is the feminine perspective. Of course, I would say the same thing to females. They cannot live life without masculinity. But they're not here, so we're not going to talk about them. We're going to talk about us. So, okay, and the reason why that is because our next thing, man's fall. Amongst your tables, take a moment to read Genesis 3, 1 through 12, and then answer these four questions. The first question can be both personal and physical. Like, how did the serpent get to Eve? Meaning, like, how did he, like, physically approach her? Or how did he, like, get into her brain kind of thing? Yeah, great. So go ahead and spend, you know, 5 minutes or so, read the text, answer the questions, and then we'll come together and we will discuss them together as one big group. That means someone at your table is going to have to be a reader. You know, in confirmation, I have to hand these out. Who's a reader? Who's a reporter? Who's a recorder? Reader, recorder, reporter. It's an old teaching thing. When you work in groups. I'm sorry, not one more minute. 30, yeah, we're done. Okay, that's 5 minutes. Wow. I gotta do a better job of anticipating how long things take. All right, we can keep our conversation going because we're going to go over this. So Genesis 3, 1 through 12, how did the serpent get to Eve? So let's think, like, physically or personally, how did you guys answer that question? How did the serpent get to Eve?
Told her where that would gain if she ate.
Yeah, right. Okay, so he got into her head, right? He said, hey, you're going to get this if you eat of it. Now, what's the foil of that? If you're going to get this, what does that mean God's going to, what is God doing right now? If you're going to get something from eating the fruit of the... Yeah, he's withholding something. So he's getting into her head by creating, lying, number one. He's by lying, because he's a liar, that's his nature. But causing Eve to doubt what God had already said. You have everything you need here in the garden. This whole thing is for you. But you can't eat of this. Now, what's interesting about that is the tree, the knowledge of good and evil, do you genuinely think that God does not want Adam and Eve to know the difference between good and evil? Just think about your answer before you blurt it out. Do you think God does not want Adam and Eve to know the difference between good and evil? Think about it for a second. Okay, what do you think? What do you, does God want us? Does God want Adam and Eve to know the difference between those two things?
I don't think he does at the beginning, before sin. He does.
Okay, wait a second though. Why not? Why not, Nick?
Well, because if you even know what evil is, you're evil. I mean, you automatically.
Okay, so Nick is sort of right. You're answering from a sinful perspective, right? So it's a really impossible question to answer completely. So let's try to go back to this time before sin. And can you know something is evil without engaging in the evil?
They had free will at that time.
Okay, so Eli, what did you say?
Should be able to.
Why should they be able to?
It's a weird way to get at it, but I mean, if the attributes of God are known from creation,
okay,
then you should be able to reason and say, okay, things that are not God,
right,
or don't have the characteristics of God, not a good thing.
Okay, so hang out, Eli's very good. Hang out of that for a second. Ben.
Because God also commands them not to eat the fruit. So that also is a open statement, don't do that.
So what do they know about eating it? It is, in fact, it's evil. Yeah. So, but I like your response, Nick, because it's really good in terms of the complexity of our own personal situation right now, because we're on the flip side. Do we know what's really good from our sinful perspective? No. We need someone to show us, and that is God.
I was also thinking about eternity, the new heaven, the new earth. Are we going to know evil then?
Yeah, so good question.
We won't even have an opportunity to sin at that point.
Well, but we still will have free will. This is really important. This is a great discussion. This is precisely why we need to have it as men, because you brought up the second point. We're going to come back to that in a second. So Eli says evil is an academic subject at this point in Adam and Eve's world. It's an abstraction that they've learned. But who is going to tell them, who's going to teach them between the difference between good and evil? It's God, because he's the only one who knows. So them taking the fruit is a confession that they what? Don't need God for them to teach that. But of course, that's wrong. I mean, they can't know that. So this is the thing about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and it's something where it's sort of speculative, but there's a Christian tradition who says that, in fact, it's not the knowledge of good and evil that's sinful, it's them taking the fruit. Because God is the one who actually wanted to give them that knowledge, but they decided to do it on their own. Andrew.
I remember I never aware about like what the first sin was and who sinned first, or they kind of like finish line. Was it Eve eating the fruit, or was it Adam letting the serpent get past her?
Right. Okay, good.
Did the blame on one or the other? Did it happen a photo finish?
Okay, this is good because this precisely goes to how did the serpent get to Eve, and was Adam and Eve together when the serpent approached Eve?
Yeah.
How do we know that beyond a shadow of a doubt? Genesis 2:15. It is not good for man to be alone. Okay, so they're not alone. Okay, no one's alone here, because it would go against the Bible. So Adam and Eve are together. They're not alone. So here's the thing. Andrew. Did Adam and Eve, you know, who sinned first? Yes. I mean, that's just all I can say, is that humanity participated in the first sin, both male and female. How did Adam, since we're men here, how did Adam participate in that first sin? What did he not do? He did not intervene. He was called to be a steward of God's creation. He was called to love Eve. So Adam let the serpent get to Eve, basically. And Eve fell for Satan's lies. She trusted the serpent's words more than God's words. So it's a topsy-turvy world at this point now. But we're going to focus on Adam. What is Adam's first experience once he ate the fruit of the tree, the knowledge of good and evil? What's his experience? Yeah, he saw he's naked. So what did that cause him to feel? Yeah, okay, yeah, right. No, this is absolutely correct. So let's just rank, I mean, in what order? I have no idea. Shame, lust. We also know another thing he experienced.
Fear.
Those are the big doozies. Shame, lust, and fear. Shame about himself. He's naked. Lust, because now he does not look at Eve as a person, but now has twisted his view of her. That's not as explicit in the scripture. Shame and fear are very explicit, but lust most likely is part of it just based on what they do, which is the next thing. What's the first action after he ate the fruit? What did he do? Yeah, he covers his genitals and then hides from Eve and God. Jumps in the bushes, basically. And of course, why does he do that? Shame and fear. Okay, now God comes along, right? And, you know, the what's interesting about verse 6, and they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. Cool of the day, that's like a, so this is like a prescribed time. This is most likely God is, he's coming to show up. This is like his Sunday morning. Shows up. Matins, you know. David.
It is the time that Adam should be working.
Yeah, okay, so this is, you're extrapolating out now the effects of what sin does. He is now at the cool of the day, is at the beginning of the day, most likely, of course. And this is the time where he wakes up and he's supposed to begin being a steward of the land. He's supposed to shamar in ovada or oboda, the land. But he's not, he's hiding. So there's a lot of crazy effects happening in these first 6 verses of Genesis chapter 3. But his strategy for making right, of course, is blaming Eve. But not just Eve, right? He blames God. Yeah, so the woman you gave me. Now maybe if I had a better woman. Maybe if you did it better, God. Well, okay. The reason why I bring that up is because as frustrating as it is, and maybe in our culture today, we have to take a hard look at ourselves, okay? All right, so, but the thing is, though, is now that Adam's life is just saturated with fear, because if he is going to live like he was, kind of freely out, there's a huge risk that's gonna happen. Because if he lives freely, he's exposing himself now to Eve, who is a sinner, and how is she going to look at Adam? Well, David said maybe lustfully, maybe. But probably she's going to disrespect him. I mean, there's this lack of respect because he basically, he didn't do what he was supposed to do. And so for him then to not cover himself, to hide himself, is means he's afraid of love. There's a fear of love, and rightfully so, though, because Eve's a sinner. But the most tragic part of it is the fact that he's hiding from God. who's already committed himself to Adam. So he's hiding himself from the one who loves him the most. So love always involves risk now and trust, because risk and trust have to be part of love, because it needs to be free, which means you can't have control over it. And Adam is precisely doing the opposite. He's trying to gain control. God, you screwed up. Eve, you screwed up. If you did this and that, then I wouldn't have done that, and everything would be just fine. Okay. In the video, we talked about the word vulnerability. You guys remember, those who watched it, like, what's the Latin root for vulnerability? What's the Latin root, the word? It means wound. So now Adam has been wounded, self-inflicted, of course, and then also wounded from Eve's probably disgusted look at him. And the only way he's going to return back to where he was at is by revealing himself, by being naked, not just physically, but emotionally, spiritually. And the only way he can do that is if he actually reveals his wounds. And think about a man who reveals his wounds in today's culture. What will he be called? Effeminate? Yep. Loser. Weak. Yep. Oof. That's not something I want to do. I'm not interested in doing that. But of course, this is precisely the moment where a man needs to be restored. Let's see if it works. Man, boom. Who is the man who then reveals all of his wounds? And then his wounds become basically the portal into paradise. What's Jesus, right? Isaiah 53, verse 5. By his wounds we are healed. Yes, that is about the crucifixion. That is about the physical pain. That's about the nails piercing. But it is also a restoration of him participating in the wounds that resulted from Adam's sin. And we'll actually look at John chapter 19 here in a minute. But those wounds now are not a source of shame. But what are they a source of? God's love. So this is the risk that we as men have to take when we become Christians and we believe in Jesus, is that we have to now become vulnerable to Christ so that he can then heal our wounds, and then those wounds then become a source of freedom. We see that explicitly in the resurrection, but before we get to that, Hebrews chapter 12, 1 and 2. Let's just turn to it. Hebrews chapter 12. Some of you might just know that off the top of your head, but boy, I can't turn my Bible pages and talk at the same time. Okay, here we go. All right, well, let's just look at Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2. Let's just do that. Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Okay, so the joy set before him. What is the joy set before him? Well, it's the quest to recover his loved ones. Just like the boy has to climb the tree, he has to climb the rocks, now God has to climb, or Jesus has to climb Mount Calvary and the cross itself. But the important thing is despising the shame of the cross. Why? Just think about Adam now and Jesus. Why is there shame involved in the crucifixion? Just think, really think like in pictures right now.
He's naked on the cross.
That is exactly it. Jesus is naked on the cross. He's despising the shame. He has exposed himself completely to the world. He is the new Adam who has not hid himself in the bushes and covered his genitals. He has let them all hang out and his wounds. Now, that's what Hebrews 12 verse 2 is, despising the shame. It's explicitly.
They never put a loincloth.
No, goodness no. That's an invention. Everybody who was crucified was naked, absolutely naked, and naked for more long time. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, he the whole thing. The only time he probably wasn't naked was when. Yeah, they dressed him in the purple robe. Crown of thorns, purple robe, staff in his hand. They're mocking him. This is a mockery. But, of course, they're the fool, right? Because he is the king of the Jews. He is the king of the universe. He's all these things. He's the new Adam. So everything they're trying to do to shame him, Jesus, of course, knows the whole Bible, and he is now restoring the whole nine yards. So this is why the crucifixion is so important for us, because the wounds of Jesus are wounds of love, and the scars reveal the length in which Jesus goes to love. I mean, this is the beauty of the fact that the wounds are not healed in the resurrection. They touch him, and then that's how they know. All right, tonic masculinity of Jesus. Oh, we got a cruise here. What is a tonic? Something you mix with gin, right? Yeah. Gin and tonic? I prefer a vodka and tonic with a lime twist, but but a tonic is something that invigorates, refreshes, and restores us. All right, now we're not going to turn to this, but 2 Corinthians 12, 7 through 10, this is a very famous passage. Some of you probably know it. Paul pleads with the Lord three times to take a thorn out of his flesh. There's a lot of theories on what that was, but it was something that caused him weakness. And Paul says that he's going to boast. And what does Paul boast? He actually boasts in his weakness. So Paul, participating in the salvation that Jesus has given him, and in the restoration of his masculinity, now actually uses his weakness as a sign of strength. And he talks about how this thorn in his flesh has persecuted him, has made him weak. And Jesus, so he prays to Jesus to remove it. And Jesus says, no, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. So Paul boasts in his weakness, which from a worldly perspective looks like he is weak. So is Paul a doormat or a simp? It's a word I learned. Yes. Does everyone know what a simp is? I actually don't know what that word technically means, but it means kind of like a boyfriend who's a doormat, right? Like, I'm looking at the younger table over here, specifically David.
It's like wimpy and sympathetic put together.
Oh! Good. I just learned the word riz recently, so. Avery was there when I learned that one. Colors. Okay. So sympathetic and wimpy at the same time. Is Paul a doormat or a simp? No. He's very strong. So he exposes his weakness, exposes his wounds, and in fact, that's precisely the moment where Jesus strengthens him. Okay. But the part I want to get to is here in a second. So the point is, though, then, is real masculinity is always a gift to the world. Your masculinity, your manhood is always a gift to the world, and that is precisely what happened when we're wrong in the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 3, is that Adam did not give himself. He did not embrace his masculinity, and he did not give. Of course, as men, we give, we receive, and love. In the video, Bill quotes this from John Paul II, Theology of the Body, and I just have it up here just because it's really good. But we gotta get to John chapter 19. So the man ought to have been from the beginning the guardian of the reciprocity of the gift. That means the exchange of love between the man and the woman. And then it's true balance, meaning that he's not a doormat, he's not a simp. Both men and women are giving and receiving. It's the thing about the duet, how the boy and the girl are showing strength, they're living in relationship to one another. There is this like life-giving, dynamic relationship between them. Although maintaining the balance of the gift seems to be something entrusted to both, that's true, the man has a special responsibility, as if it depended more on him whether the balance is kept or violated, or even if it has already been violated, reestablished. That is something which we see precisely in Jesus. That's why. Turn to John chapter 19. I'm just going to cruise through these next things here real quick. Shamar, Obota, Adam was supposed to guard and protect, Obota cultivate, care for, Eve is the garden. We're going to do something on Song of Solomon. We'll get that in spades there, so I'm just going to skip ahead here. Okay, John chapter 19, verse 5, but I think it's verse 3. Is it verse 5? Yeah, is that verse 3? Well, that is verse 5, okay. Okay, so this is at the end. Jesus is arrested. He's going to be crucified, and Pilate brings him out to the people. And so Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns, the purple robe, and Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Very important statement, because if it's in Hebrew, what did Pilate just say? Behold Adam. What is he dressed as? King of the universe. Royalty. Behold the man. But of course we know in a moment he's going to be naked. So, Jesus is called the man. In Hebrew, behold Adam. Okay, now let's skip down. So, let's skip down then to John chapter 19, 26 through 30. Okay, now Jesus is on the cross. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Okay, in the same chapter, we have Jesus called the man, and then we have Mary called the woman. What is happening here? This is a recreation. This is the restoration of both man and woman, where Jesus as the new Adam and Mary as the new Eve are coming together, and what is happening? They're having a child. So man and woman, and the be fruitful and multiply, is happening precisely in the moment where the new Adam shows his love and gives his body for the sake of the woman. Now I know when people take this literally, you're like, oh, it's his mother. Oh, it's weird. No, Mary is the church in this instance. It's symbolic, it's metaphor, at the same time historical. But Jesus is doing precisely what Adam didn't do. Satan comes in and is trying to attack Eve. And what does Adam not do? He doesn't intervene. He doesn't give himself up for Eve. He doesn't throw himself in between Satan and Eve and give his body up. He lets it happen right in front of him. Just tragic. Okay, now, Satan is attacking the world. He is attacking the Son of God through the Roman centurions, through the Jewish rulers. And what is Jesus going to do? He intervenes. He puts himself in between Eve and Satan and gives up his body. He gives up his body precisely as a naked man. He exposes all of the shame of masculinity and then restores it completely. I've answered all these questions. So, all right. Jesus is the foil to Adam. He is the new Adam. He's the one who restores our masculinity. And I bring this up because was Jesus ever married? No, he wasn't married. I mean, he was married to the church, but he didn't have a wife on earth. So this is why Jesus is so important for us, because he encapsulates all aspects of masculinity, whether you're married or not married. He's the one who lives in relationship to the feminine in a way that is congruent to the way God made us as men, as Adam. And so as we then study our masculinity, the tonic masculinity, not the toxic masculinity, but the tonic masculinity of Jesus Christ, or of Jesus, this will be our image the entire time. Is the crucifixion, is John chapter 19. Joe.
It's wild to think of Jesus as the new Adam, but then right after that, his side is pierced. And so if we take, like, Eve, like, life came out of Adam.
Yep. So this is, so Joe is kind of, he's weaving a tapestry of the restoration of the Garden of Eden. So as now, Jesus loved Eve, the new Eve, fully, completely. He gave himself up completely. Now he gets speared. The water and the blood flow out, which of course, in 1 John chapter 3, we know that this is, you know, precisely related to the sacraments and the birth of the church, or with his bride. I think I talked about this on Sunday. Adam fell asleep. God took the rib out of his side and made Eve. Jesus is crucified. He falls asleep in death, and the church is made out of his side. So it's a complete restoration of masculinity. The crucifixion is the template of what we are as men. And Jesus, by the power of the Holy Spirit, is bringing you guys into that masculinity. Which is scary, because you have to let Jesus do that. Which means you also have to be vulnerable with Jesus, which is difficult. All right, so one last thing. How does that happen? Well, through the forgiveness of sins and the presence of Jesus in us, so we are in union with Jesus, by the power of the Holy Spirit, we can reclaim our original purpose in life. We can become those men that God made us to be, and so we can live as gift. We can live as Shamar and Obodah, which I know we didn't talk about tonight, but we will talk about in Song of Solomon. The ones who guard, the ones who protect, the ones who cultivate, the ones who care for, the ones who have a special responsibility to create life, whether it's literal with children or whether it's the unitive principle of a robust joy. That's Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2 again, to cultivate life. So we can take on the role of Shamar and Obodah, along with all the other beautiful images of masculinity in the Bible, and we're going to spend the next 5 weeks, I think, taking a look at all those wonderful images. Any last questions? I know we raced at the end there, but you guys think about that. Next week, we are going to dive into more about John chapter 19 and Jesus as a bridegroom. Will be great. All right, let's head downstairs for prayers.